black, but look at the way those guys are moving around. The stuff isn't stiff. It flexes with them like a second skin.
What do you think, Doc? Does it look like any of the white coat ultra-secret tech you've seen?
Doc didn't reply. Ryan saw the blank stare, the quivering lips, and realized at once that the old man was slipping away from reality. Doc had no power to control the fits of complete disorientation, which were the result of post-traumatic shock from the time leaps he had been forced to take, leaps that had fractured his mind and broken his heart. In a second or two, he would either be talking aloud to his wife Emily and his beloved children at their dinner table, or arguing some unintelligible philosophy with a long-turned-to-dust academic crony.
Come on, Doc.
The lights went back on behind Doc's eyes. He groaned, then shook his head to clear it. Ryan repeated the question after the man had recovered his bearings.
The black armor. Did you see it when you were captive to the white coats before Skydark?
Sorry, Ryan. I've never seen anything like it.
The way they're totally encased, helmets to boots, it reminds me of the suits the NASA astronauts used to wear. They were pressurized for life support in space, had their own self-contained air and water supply, and sophisticated biometry and communication systems.
Why would they be wearing something like that in Moon Boy? Nothing's wrong with the air around here.
They'd be wearing it if they couldn't breathe our air or drink our water.
We've never seen any people like that.
Never heard of anyone like that either.
Mildred, are you saying they might not be from Earth?
It is a possible explanation. However remote, they could be extraterrestrials.
My friends, I beg you to take a closer look. Whatever else they may be, these wayfarers are neither little nor green. And at this moment in time, their point of origin, whether earthly or not, should be of less concern to us than the potential threat they present. Have they weapons we cannot defeat?
Our cannies might have their hands full trying to make dinner out of these pilgrims.
Can't count on the folks in armor doing the job for us. What if the canny bastards wait until dark to attack and then just get driven off? There's a whole lot of desert out there. We could lose them, Ryan.
They're not going to wait.
How do you know that?
He pointed toward the entry road that led up from Highway 15.
I count four cannies coming on the run.
As the companions watched, low-moving figures slipped around and through the rubble piles on the outskirts of the ville. The cannies split up, working themselves into position to attack Main Street. They crouched in plain view from the ridgetop, their stationary heads and shoulders completely exposed to down-angled blaster fire. They were challenging but not impossible targets. Ryan gritted his teeth. That was, if he'd still had a weapon that could reach out and touch somebody at 1,000 yards. Giggly Jane's jungle boots made no sound as she scampered over the broken ground of Outer Moon Boy. What the new cost hadn't swept away, human scavengers had long since torn asunder. The concrete foundation slabs of the upscale executive homes, every one a 3,500-square-foot palace fit for a baron, had been painstakingly cracked and plundered for their metal pipes and wiring. The resulting rubble had been left in scattered heaps or dumped out of the way into the craters of waterless swimming pools. Giggly Jane and her fellow pack members moved quickly, single file, from rubble heap to rubble heap. Just ahead, beyond the last piles of concrete, shanties of all sizes spilled out from the sides of the handful of surviving buildings. Some were cozy lean-tos for one made of a single piece of corrugated steel. Others were flat-roofed and big enough to sleep a dozen or more. As they drew closer, Giggly Jane could see the rude dwellings were deserted. Though no tangles of corpses decorated their packed dirt floors, the air hung thick with a maddening perfume of death. Irregularly spaced, 6-foot-long blotches of brownish slime stained the earth. In other places, much wider areas were discolored. From these patches rose the dizzying scent. She felt a powerful urge to throw herself down and roll on them like a dog. The Right Reverend Gore signaled for the group to split up, then moved off to the right with a scoped long blaster. Spadecrawler and Egregious Jones continued straight on, while Giggly Jane turned left, according to plan, cutting through the empty lots until she reached the remnants of a street. Despite what the scrounger had told them about the chill capabilities of these muties, Giggly Jane had no fear of what lay ahead. Her bravery was due partly to the wormholes the Uzi protein had already bored in her infected brain, and partly to her excitement at the promise of blood and booty. She already knew what she was going to do with her share of the spoils. True to the freewheeling, gather-no-moss Kenny lifestyle, Giggly Jane planned to use every crumb of it to trade up for better blasters and bigger knives. At the edge of the ruined street, she carefully placed her .38-caliber hand blaster beside a big chunk of concrete. She wasn't going to need the reproduction Colt to play her role in the assault. Though she was an excellent shot, her real forte was diversion, which would allow her three comrades to get into perfect position for an ambush. She shrugged out of her dress and let it fall around her boot tops. The sun blazed against her bare back, buttocks, and legs. As she stepped out of the garment, her dirt and sweat-edged breasts swayed, and their silver nipple rings and antiqued death's head ornaments tinkled sweetly. Hell's bells. After fishing the tactical one-hander knife out of a dress pocket, she concealed the serrated blade in the top of her right boot. It was the only tool she required. Giggly Jane had never learned to eat with a fork. Naked but for the boots, she set off down the lane of asphalt sand, following its sharp curve to the right until the center of Moon Boy came into view. In the middle of the street, some three blocks away, she saw the collection of strange machines and counted five figures in black. They weren't holding any weapons. Though their eyes weren't visible through the smoke-colored visors, the figures appeared to be looking at her. So she stopped in the middle of the road and did an impromptu little dance. Hands held high over her head, torso wriggling, legs spread wide, Giggly Jane bubbled over with laughter as she pumped her hips enthusiastically. Of course, her wild erotic contortions were a total sham. She had zero interest in performing actual sex with anyone, ever, because Kenny girls just wanted to have fun. The sun reflected off the nasty, lopsided patch of white scar tissue on top of Spadecrawler's head. The damned gruesome thing looked as if it was getting bigger, spreading like a rad cancer, Egregious Jones thought as he shadowed four steps behind. Over the years, he'd heard different stories about how the man had come to be so horribly disfigured, with that skanky little ear, all shriveled and puckered like an albino bat's butthole. Some said that his own mother had done it to him shortly after his birth, held him by his heels and dipped him into a bucket full of acid rain she'd collected, trying to chill him. Some said that he had done it himself by accident when he was stoned on Jolt, passed out, and fell into a bonfire. Some said that Norms had caught him bloody-handed and stacked hot coals on his head, trying to melt his murdering canny brains. For his own part, Spadecrawler never said a single word about it, one way or another. Whatever the ugly truth was, it didn't matter a blood drop. From the nose up, the man was largely fucked. And he'd stay fucked until the day his running buddies ate him, nasty scar and all. Assuming there were buddies left to do the job. The way Gore was leading the show, nothing was for sure anymore. He'd started the day with a couple of dozen cannies, the biggest, meanest pack of man-eaters this side of the Shens. And in a few hours, there were only the four survivors. To Egregious, it was no mystery why things had gone so sour so fast. Terminal Uzis had old Gore by the coattails. The way his hands shook, pretty soon he wouldn't be able to keep hold of a blade, let alone use it to cut free a nice loin chop. He turned his head to the side and spat into the dirt. Thanks to the pecking order of Kenny culture, he was going to have to let Gore take the best stuff from this raid, which had the makings of the score to end all. The juicy bits were sorely wasted on the Right Reverend. The kindest thing, to Egregious's way of thinking, would be to put a .58-caliber lead ball through both his lungs, then finish the job with a man's own stag-handled gut-hook skinner. Tough, stringy meat, for sure, but while chewing it, at least he'd know that he'd seen the last of Gore. By right of succession, he was scheduled to become the next leader of the pack, or what little remained of it. Spadecrawler entered a narrow dirt lane between shambling squatters' huts, his weapon at the ready. Built on an Italian reproduction, the rifle-stocked carbine had an 18-inch octagonal barrel. The extra-long barrel added some distance to the .44's range, without making the blaster hard to handle in close quarters. If the cowboy carbine was made to order for the job this afternoon, Egregious's blaster wasn't. As he followed Spadecrawler into the shantytown, he thumbed back the twin hammers of his Kodiak Express long blaster to half-cock. The Black Powder Big Game rifle had enough power in either barrel to bowl over a buffalo at 75 yards. The shooting distance would be about a hundredth of that if things went right. He and Spadecrawler were supposed to filter through the shacks without being seen, get as close as possible to their targets,